Hello and welcome to this episode of Better Off Read. This is episode 86. I'm Pip Adam, and in this episode I talk to Dan Coyce, writer, editor, podcaster, Dan Coyce. It's great to chat with Dan. I first met Dan a few years ago when he was in New Zealand as part of a sort of round the world trip that he was taking to write his latest book, which is called How to Be a Family, and it's got this great subtitle of the year, I Dragged My Kids Around the World to Find a New Way of to Be Together. And it's a great book, and it was lovely to meet Dan. And so we talk together today about Dennis Johnson's 2011 novella Train Dreams, which I say, I was just editing this podcast and I say over and over again with boring rapidity that it's a revolution. I also talk at length about a short story which I cannot remember. If anyone knows what this short story is, you would put me out of my misery quite quickly. It was by Dennis Johnson. I read it in an anthology. It was about a soldier who was on like R&R in Hawaii maybe, and he sleeps on the beach. There you go. Yeah. Oh, I'm like those people that go into record stores and do you know this one? Anyway, I was very grateful to chat with Dan. He has got a wonderful mind, and it was really great to sort of have him sort of like respond to this book in a way that sort of opened up some possibilities for me, which was just fantastic. So I hope you enjoy this podcast, and thank you very much. Hello, Dan, how are you?
Good, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for asking me along.
I'm really glad you're here too. Thank you so much. So we are here today to talk about Dennis Johnson's Train Dreams, a book that I am just dying to talk to you about. It's just, it's a revelation to me. But I wondered if we could start, if you would be willing to introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Dan Coyce. I'm a writer at Slate Magazine, which is a web magazine in the United States. I mean, we think of ourselves as worldwide, of course, but we're based in the United States. I'm also a freelancer and a nonfiction writer here in the States. I live in Arlington, Virginia. Among the things I've written is a book called How to Be a Family, which covers the year that me and my wife and our two kids spent traveling around the world, including a wondrous 3 months right there in Wellington, New Zealand. And a lot of the book is about how I found New Zealand bewitching us all.
Oh, man. We loved having you here. It was very exciting.
One of the many things I loved about New Zealand was that everyone was very free to have fun lunches with us, including the entire Adam family. It was really great.
Yes. Bo, Brent, me. It was wild. It was wild. Now, can we talk a little bit about you've seen a few books. I was very keen to read this one. Can you talk about why this is a book that you like to talk about?
Yeah, this is a really meaningful book to me, Train Dreams. You know, Dennis Johnson, I think most readers know him best from Jesus's Son, his collection of short stories that came out in the 90s that was turned into a movie with Billy Crudup in it. He later won a lot of prizes, including, I think, the National Book Award for his Vietnam novel, Tree of Smoke. And even before Jesus' Son, he was writing sort of very revelatory, incantatory fiction through the late 70s and 80s, plus poetry, plus plays. He's really, in the United States, among writers particularly, he's quite a beloved figure for the way that his fiction evolved, the way that his career evolved, and the way that he seemed always to be sort of singing his own tune in a way that maybe other writers didn't always feel comfortable doing, and how those books always just seem to hit really hard. Train Dreams is a novella, really. It's only about, 100 pages long, I think. And it was published in 2003 initially in the Paris Review. And then the book version of it was published as a standalone hardcover and paperback here in the States in 2010. And I described it recently in a sort of end of the decade piece for Slate as I think the best piece of fiction published in the decade of the 2010s by an American writer. I just find it a slim book that is absolutely stuffed with wonders that completely changed the way I think about writing about the past, changed the way I think about masculinity and presenting emotion in fiction, and which I have returned to over and over and over again to just find new wonders in it. But I've never really had the chance to talk about it, and only a little bit to write about it. So I was very excited to introduce someone to this book and to have a chance to chat.
Yeah, this is a revelation to me. I think maybe Jesus' Son is so well known in New Zealand, perhaps because Alison MacLean directed the movie. So
oh, yes, that's
like
true.
New Zealand. Yeah. So I think, I don't know, like, I think that's probably how I came to it, because I think Alison MacLean's one of our greatest filmmakers. But yeah, this was a revelation to me. I have read Jesus' Son, and I've also read this short story about a soldier on R&R in Hawaii, which I think may even come from the novel. And that short story, I finished it and thought, oh yeah, that was a short story. And but it is one of the short stories that has stayed with me more than any other short story that I can remember. Like, I think about it almost weekly. And this book is just a revelation to me. And I felt a lot as I was reading it. And then when I started thinking about it, I have a few like really baseline confusions about historical fiction, and this book kind of helped me with it. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about, like, I just wonder what it means to recall a past in contemporary times. Like, you know, how much of the now is in this book, do you think? Or you talked about how it sort of realigned your thinking around historical fiction. What do you think it's up to in that way?
A lot of stuff. You know, Johnson wrote he wrote historical fiction that was sort of grounded in active cultural memory, right? His big Vietnam book was a kind of work of rethinking the way we tell those kinds of stories that are quite familiar in American literature, particularly. He's got an early novel called Fiscadoro, which I have always thought of as historical post-apocalyptic fiction, in which it clearly takes place in some future, but it's written of from the context of someone who is as if they are looking back on that time. Train Dreams is a little different from both of those because it's more like Fiscadoro than it is like Tree of Smoke because the time he's writing about, except for the very, very last days of Robert Grenier's life, are far out of memory of anyone living, right? The Pacific Northwest in the late 1800s and early 20th century. Everyone who might possibly have lived that life is long gone now. And so it's completely reconstructed out of, you know, research and imagination. And there's no part of it that can be drawn directly from the writer's life, presumably, at least no part of the historical aspect. And so when I find myself reading this book and feeling as though I have been dropped not only into a place but into a brain that seems appropriate to that era, I find it really moving to be able to be inside Robert Grenier's heart and mind and to recognize in him versions of the trials and tribulations that I or anyone of our era goes through, but clearly refracted through this lens of the past, clearly unique in many ways to this time. The book that it reminds me of from a historical fiction context, honestly, is the Hilary Mantel trilogy, Wolf Hall and the other ones, in which those are obviously much more, those have a much broader lens and are much more concerned with, with the world outside of the purview of their main character, but they're also very closely held inside that main character and are a clear attempt to think not only what was the world like then, but what were people like then? What was it like to be a person living then? And how did that affect you? And I find that most books, that's a hard thing to imagine. And the tools that Mantell use and that Johnson use to get us into that world, I think are pretty remarkable.
Because I think that is one of the things that I found really interesting. And this is one of my issues. This is one of my trickinesses around historical fiction is often it feels like we take modern sensibility and put it in the past, you know, like, and people, you know, there's always a hero who is anti-Nazi and there's always, you know what I mean? Like there's someone who has this very modern day thinking, you know, in the past. And I think that some of the ways this book deals, especially with Indigenous Americans, like I feel like there is this sort of almost, absence in a lot of American writing that sort of talks about the past, but there's something really special going on here around, you know, that I think about that Toni Morrison quote about how, you know, we don't only meet white people all day, so why would we only write about white people in our novels? But yeah, I don't know, am I wrong? Have I just not read broadly enough, or is there something quite distinct about this?
Well, there's a long tradition of Western writing in the United States, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
is that ranges broadly from sort of like dime store pulp novels of the first, you know, 70 or 80 years of the century to sort of popular literary writers like Larry McMurtry, who in books like Lonesome Dove certainly the native population is present, if usually presented as an other in all of those books. Like and Train Dreams isn't exactly different, right? It's primary native character is Kootenai Bob, who is a sort of acquaintance of Robert Grenier, who you know gives sort of spooky predictions about someone's dog and but who also lives a kind of unique and singular life in the context of the community where Robert Grenier lives as this teetotaling Indian, as they think of him, who will never touch a drop because he knows of, you know, of alcohol's inherent evil. And so to my mind, you know, I certainly am not an expert in Native literature and the way that Natives have been treated in contemporary American literature. But to my mind, one way that this differs is in this sense that this character, Kootenai Bob, and the way that he intersects with Grenier's life, in the same way that the Chinese laborers who are presented in a couple different ways early in the novel are presented as part of Grenier's life, are firmly part of the texture of the everyday workaday life that he lives in these places and are not particularly exceptional or representative. And there's a scene I think of a lot in this book when I think of the character of Kootenai Bob, which happens after his death. Remember he is fooled into drinking a shandy because someone tells him it contains no alcohol. And it's the first alcohol he's ever drunk in his life. And I'm sure you may or may not know, but as in the Maori community in New Zealand, there's a higher incidence of alcoholism in the native community, even to this day. And that's something that has happened ever since the introduction of alcohol by white settlers. And so this vision of this guy being tricked into drinking alcohol for the first time and it just completely unraveling essentially his entire life in one like 10-hour period. And then he then stumbles off to the train tracks and is disassembled by a number of trains running over him in the night. So that scene is striking, but then the scene that really stays with me is the one afterwards where we're told much later in the novel that for the several years following that, trains coming through the valley We're told by the company that runs the trains to please proceed slowly through the valley and to lay on your whistle for a couple of miles before you get to the area where Kootenai Bob died, because the people of his tribe were still trying to find all the pieces of him. And this weird respect and honor given to this thoroughly disrespected and dishonored man by not only the people of the community after his death, and not only the people of his tribe after his death, but by this railroad, the administrators of this railroad who realize the thing that they owe to these people, I found striking and remarkable. And I think maybe more representative of the mixture of disrespect and grudging tolerance that I think characterized the relationships between white people and Native Americans in the second half of the 19th century. And it isn't written, as you say, from the context of today, right? There's no valorization of the Native characters, and there's no demonization of the white characters who treat them poorly. It's presented really matter-of-factly. But there's also not the other thing that often I find happens in historical fiction, where the intolerant attitudes of before are given this kind of like lurid, can you believe this shit treatment? You know, that's not there either. Instead, it's this one guy who lived this one particular kind of brave life, was completely undone in a way that makes total sense, and then is accorded this kind of post-mortem respect, and whose life rings through the life of our protagonist throughout his days. And I find that really moving.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I was just thinking when you were talking about, I always think of those Mad Men scenes with the mothers smoking around their children. You know, yes, like we often like get to like self-congratulate ourselves. Right. And I think
look at those fuckers.
Yeah, look, what were they thinking?
Right.
And this is what I so loved about the book, is that it brings, you know, it brings you into sharper relief with history in a way that, you know, like I sort of thought, oh yeah, I'm culpable too, you know. And I totally love the way you described that. And I was thinking, you know, this character of Grenier, you know, like is just so perfect. And like in amongst it all, like one of the things you've talked about is him as a father, mm-hmm. and this idea of masculinity that you're talking about, and the way that, you know, it starts with this very macho act, you know, like this sort of act of violence, but
man, an act masculinity. Of violence in which he's sort of drafted unwittingly and then finds himself carried along in ways that haunt him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and this is what I think, is that there's something interesting happening in the book about how masculinity is performed as well. And I think that it has this intersection with fatherhood. And I mean, in a way, it kind of brings me back to your book, you know, this idea of how do we represent fatherhood? You know, like, I don't know, like, have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, so, you know, Robert Grenier spends Train Dreams, I think, performing, as you say, the very specific acts of masculinity as defined in the context of his time, right? He works as a logger for many years, and after that works, he runs a team of horses and does transport among, you know, small Western towns. He marries and has a child. He works as a logger, for example, until his body betrays him, until it basically falls apart in his late 30s. But at the same time, the book is very attendant to his emotional core. And it's remarkable to me how frequently this character, this rugged masculine character, is completely overcome by different kinds of emotion. By grief, or by anxiety, or by sadness. There's that scene at the end where he stops going to church because when he sits in church long enough and listens to the hymns, he starts to realize just how sad he is all the time, and he can't stop crying. He's overcome in the very end of the book by lust, and it's completely unfamiliar to him, and he doesn't even know what to do with himself. And the combination of this archetypal Western outdoorsman who is occupied in the jobs of Manifest Destiny, right? He's clearing forests and building bridges for trains and doing all the things that men did to open the West for the United States. But at the same time, we inside his head with him are attendant to everything that concerns him, all of those fears and all of that grief and guilt. I find that such a potent way to write about a man at this time. And the connection that the book builds between him and his daughter, who dies as a very small child in a horrible fire that also takes his wife away, and then in a completely unexpected way is returned to him late in the book as a wolf girl who is adopted mm-hmm. by wolves, and years later shows up in his front yard with a broken leg, and he is given one last chance to care for this child. It just, you know, I came to the story in 2010 when my children were young, when they were 5 and 3. And the way that scene hit me then, of this father who lost everything, but who was given one last completely unnatural and insane way to connect with a daughter who doesn't know him, who is specifically described as not even human anymore, but to whom he still feels this emotional tie, was tremendously moving. And then now, 10 years later, when my children are much older and all I can think about is the ways in which they're soon to leave me and how I will define myself in the years afterwards, the kinds of grief that will represent to me, which are obviously different from Robert Grenier's horrible grief, but nevertheless related. I find that moving in a completely different way. The notion that that even without my children's full understanding, even as they are off in the world living their own lives, there are ways for me to still feel as though to still do something for them, even if it in the long story of their lives is minor. The realization of how major it will be for me in the short story I have remaining left in mine means a lot. And I don't know if that's what Dennis Johnson is trying to convey through that. I think that there are also a lot of more primal things about nature and its unknowable majesty going on in those scenes. But it is funny to me how much I grabbed onto the fatherhood aspect of this book. And sort of used it as a little bit of a security blanket over the last 10 years of trying to raise kids.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting because I read this once reading, and then I listened to a really great audiobook of it, and I was walking, and it was the second time I had come to that part in the book, and it just stopped me in my tracks, and I had to feel quite emotional now thinking about it. Like, I just had to sit, and I just think you've just captured it so well, the way you described it. And one of the interesting things that you've done in your life is that you have captured a part of your family's kind of I don't know what you'd call it, like the legacy or the history of your family in your book, you know, How to Be a Family, and you were writing quite close to the time that it was happening. And I just wonder, that act, you know, what is it to sort of have read a book like this and then to go about capturing fatherhood in this way and familyhood in this way? Like, I don't know.
The book is so elemental, right? It's so concerned with the span and sweep of history, and even the individual scenes in it are presented as sort of like lightning flashes in the continual storm of the death of the 19th century and the birth of the 20th century. Like, you never lose that sense that we're not just seeing Robert Grenier's life, we're seeing these 75 years like the, you know, the most consequential 75 years in American history, you can argue. But seeing the way that his relationship with his wife, you know, the that courtship scene, the scene with them sitting in the flowers where he finally musters up the courage to propose to her.
So good.
The way that the scenes with his daughter and his memories of them are presented throughout that life. When I was writing How to Be a Family, you're right that I was writing it very close in time, to the extent that I was writing the New Zealand section while I was in New Zealand. You know, not only because I didn't want to lose material, but also for the totally mercenary reason that I needed to turn in a third of the book in order to get my next advance payment from my publisher, and we couldn't afford to buy our plane tickets back from the Netherlands unless I turned in some of the book, and the section I had to turn in was the New Zealand section. And so I would do interviews, or the kids would come home from school and some particular thing would happen, or I would get in a fight with Lyra or Harper, my daughters, and I would just be immediately like, all right, I got to go fucking write this down and turn this, I got to turn this into copy. A way it was almost more like, it was, in many ways, it was very reminiscent of blogging. Right? It was like these things happen and I'm processing them instantly. And I had chances later on to return to those scenes and think about them some more and revisit them, you know, with a little bit of perspective, with 6 months of perspective or a year of perspective, but it was all still very immediate. And that's the way we live our parenting lives for the most part, right? We live them just trying to survive from day to day and to figure out, well, what does this insane thing that has happened to my child mean now? We envision ourselves, I think, as thinking of the whole sweep of our children's childhoods and what the people we're turning them into will eventually be. That's important to us, but it's very difficult to ever look on the act of parenting with any kind of perspective. And probably that's for the best, because it would be totally overwhelming, right? If we were constantly thinking, every time I do think, well, what kind of adult will this turn Lyra into, this interaction we're having? I find myself completely paralyzed by the act, because you can't do it that way. But as a writer, it's very valuable to keep both the instantaneous and the big picture in mind. And writing that book was a constant struggle between wanting to present sort of as kind of immediate a scene as possible, while also trying to think about the big picture of not only my children's lives, but why we were doing this trip in the first place, what it was meant to do for our family, what it was meant to teach us, and how I hoped it would change us in a way that it would become a kind of defining story for our family, right? I think your family and every family have certain things about them that they think of as like their defining things. We're the family who X. I don't know what it is for your family.
Yeah.
For my family, I wanted it to be at least one of the things. I wanted us to be the family that took this adventure and transformed the way we dealt with each other. And so, you know, that's not the same as living 75 years at the fulcrum of American history, but it requires a similar kind of not forgetting about the big picture, even as you're wrapped in individual moments.
And that, I mean, I am always grateful for your podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, because I think this kind of easing up is useful from, I don't even know if that's the right word, but I always feel that at any point I'm parenting this person who is older than they've ever been. I'm older than I've ever been. We're at a moment of time. What worked half an hour ago will not work now, kind of stuff.
And thinking about it as working often is unconstructive in and of itself.
Yeah. And that's what I think is so great about your book as well, is that it kind of is about process rather than end result. And I don't know, I think it's a magnificent book. And I just, I just, and also just that stuff you're saying, which I think sort of ties back to this book as well, is the points that we remember, you know what I mean? Like, it astounds me sometimes that now that my son as an older person will come to me and say, remember that time X, and I'm trying to make certain memories in other areas that are now forgotten. But, you know, I just think, and this is what I think is astounding when you talk about the sweep that's in Train Dreams, is that, like, you know, Elvis is in the book, but also logging to make way for railways is in the book.
Right.
You know, completely, you know, like the beginning of settling in places that have not been settled by white people before is in the book, but also, you know, and this idea of hindsight and where we put our memories is so interesting. And it must be interesting to sort of, like, because the book isn't that old, but your book, but I just think it will be so interesting as time goes on for everybody to look at it again and think, oh yeah, that was the thing. And
yeah, or even me, right? I did when the book came out in 2019.
It's been 100 years since that, and yeah, that's right, just right. In 2020. Yeah.
Yeah, it was basically a year ago now that the book came out. And, you know, I did a bunch of readings and blah, blah, blah. But then I hadn't really done anything promotionally with the book for quite some time. And I did a reading just like 2 or 3 weeks ago on, you know, a Zoom reading, as we do now. and, you know, the section I read, I didn't recognize those kids at all. Like, the kids in that section were, you know, it's been 4 years essentially since I was doing these things with those children. And and they were complete aliens to me. And so it's like a kind of time capsule just for me and my family. I'm really grateful to it. I love that you mentioned Elvis, because he comes up near the end of this book. And I want to talk with you a little bit about the last little bit of this book.
Oh, please. The way that the
book talks about a specific sound, and it's there in the title, right? Train Dreams. Mm-hmm. The titular dreams of that the book is referring to are dreams that Robert Grenier has living in his cabin. As the train goes past, he will find the sound of the whistle intruding upon his dreams. And that sound, this kind of unearthly wail, gets written about over and over and over again in this book. Trains make it, coyotes make it, wolves make it. Robert Grenier makes it for a long period in the middle of his life. He howls to just to make himself feel better. At the end of the book, the wolf boy howls. He makes this unearthly sound that stills everyone in the theater in town who had previously laughed at him. And I don't think it's an accident that the thing that marks the advent of like modernity in this book is Elvis Presley, because what the fuck does that guy do, right? He howled in a way that terrified people at his time because of how primal it was, but he also meant the coming of like a whole new kind of world. And like reading this book for the umpteenth time and tracing these sounds as they went through it, it reminded me, A, how carefully constructed this thing is. It's like 107 perfect pages, basically. But also, it made me think, as a writer, what an incredibly useful tool that is to return over and over again to a sound. I know that you're very interested in sounds. To return over and over again to a sound, to explore it from a bunch of different angles, to let your main character hear it, feel it, make it, and then to have that be the last thing in the book, right? The last thing in this book is the sort of the sound of a wolf howling. It's also sort of the sound of a man howling. It's the sound of people of the past being quieted by a sound from the future. And boy, does it have a powerful impact. And like, it just is a thing to steal as a writer. How valuable is that?
Because that's, I must... yeah, like, I mean, there is so much that I freaking love about this book, but there's something about that noise that was incredibly visceral for me. Like, you know, that noise that there's something about the particular frequency of the noise that I was imagining and was being described, that not only resonates when you're making it, but seems to resonate when you're hearing it as well in the body in similar places. Like there's something, like I don't know anything about primal screaming except that it was big in the 90s here. I don't know, like, you know, but there is something just so, and it just seems to be this noise that sort of, I kept thinking about, okay, now I'm going to be embarrassing. It's called On Walden Pond, isn't it? The Thoreau. How do you say his name?
It's just called
name?
Walden.
Walden, yeah.
Yeah,
so
it's
like
Thoreau.
Thoreau, yeah. Like, I just, when I did American literature at university, we learnt about this idea of sort of this energy that goes through everything, which, you know, like, resonated with me because of sort of Modi and, you know, this idea that, you know, there's something in us and then there's something not when we die, and you know that this energy kind of goes through everything. And I was thinking about that Thor, the noise of the Thor that's in Walden, but there's just something so like you say, everything is making this resonating noise, and then the artificial, the man-made, the robot of the train kind of comes in and starts to make this noise as well, and then Elvis Presley's there and the Wolf Boy's there, and oh my god, it's just
the scene
genius.
Really early in the book when he's at the logging site with the Simpson Company, it's on page 13, and this crazy scene where we hear the noises of the machines that are clearing the forest. The engine was an old wood-burning steam colossus, throbbing and booming and groaning while its vapors roared like a falls. The number of times that the sounds of machinery are compared to the sounds of nature in this book is remarkable. And then there's a later moment in which, I gotta find it because it's so good, where people are described as essentially moving in a silent movie against the backdrop of the overwhelming noise of the machinery. And that happens again and again too, where the noise is so much that it like erases the voice and almost the person that is there. And the connection between the line that this book draws between the natural phenomena of nature, the wolves and the groaning of the trees as they fall, and then the machinery that destroys it, and the emotion of the uncontrollable natural emotions of the people, the man who is part of all of this, like there's no difference between those in this book. And I think you're right that it has a lot to do with that animating force of like the pastoralists and the 19th century, the great 19th century writers, right? It's that same throbbing, animating force that they believed was God, God and the earth speaking through them. But in this book, it seems more like the connection between man and his works and the world that they move through. And if anything, you asked very early in our conversation, well, what is the now of this book? And that's a now of this book, right? It's pretty hard to read that scene where his wife comes back to him as a spirit and he is transported to what it was like inside the cabin as the fire roared through, and not think about the sort, you know, the faltering connection between humans and the natural world that we're all living in now. That's very present there, and you can only read it through that lens, right, in this summer of 2020, this summer of fires. And that I just find that so fun as a reader and scary as a person.
Yeah, and like, I mean, I've never really understood the fascination with trains. Like, I just don't know why. But this book just freaking, it turned me on to trains, man. Like, I was just like, oh my god, you know. And I think you know, that I must admit, and this is probably a fault in my reading, but I did sort of read it almost as science fiction, you know, almost as kind of, you know, like almost like The Martian or something like that. Like just this idea that, you know, because of my weird relationship with nature, mm-hmm. and, you know, sort of growing up in a more urban kind of thing, and, you know, my family never went hiking or anything. I think I'm quite scared of nature. And
you're like the one this kiwi.
Yeah. I get told off a lot. Mm-hmm. But, like, just this idea of kind of, like, these machines coming through, and like those weird ideas of kind of, I'm doing inverted commas, but kind of like civilizing nature. And I don't know, like I just don't know. There is something so incredible about the way that he writes. Like, because it wasn't until I finished it, I think, you know, like the second time where I thought, because I always have trouble with that movie Forrest Gump, like I'm just, and I often think historical fiction can be like that, where it's like he was everywhere,
right.
But there is just something so clever about the way this book is written that just tricks me into getting that sweep, but not, you know, not banging me on the head with it. And I think you're right, I think it's the internal stuff. You're writing at the moment, and I'm wondering, like, I know what this book did to my writing for the week. Like, I just got, I never wanted to write again, and I also wanted to write more than ever. You know, like, it was this weird thing where I was like, it's been done, no need. But also at the same time, I was like, oh my God, writing can do this. And I'm just wondering, like, do you read while you're writing, or do you try not to read while you're writing? You know, I know that when you were writing the New Zealand parts of your book, you were very actively reading New Zealand literature.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, you know, like, how, I'm very interested in that interaction between reading and writing.
I find it unbelievably useful to read while I'm writing,
yeah.
even if
yeah.
it sometimes gives you that, oh, I could never fucking do that feeling. I mean, with nonfiction, you know, it's, there's research reading, of course, which fuels almost any nonfiction that you're going to write. But there's also, you're right that while I was, for example, writing the New Zealand parts of How to Be a Family, I found it so welcoming and useful to read New Zealand fiction. So, you know, reading you and Emma Neal and other writers, and then reading essays, you know, Ashley Young's essays and many other writers. I found that really helpful, not because I necessarily pulled things from those the way you pull stuff from research, but because they help me sort of, when you're writing, there's always this battle to get your head back in the place that it was the last time you were writing, to get your brain to pick up in the stream wherever you last were. And so much of the time I spend writing, especially as a writer with kids, where you're constantly interrupted, and it's very hard to find the sort of focused time away that is the traditional environment of the writer. Like, right, we think of whatever was a Wallace Stevens walking to his insurance office in his suit and tie, and then he had hours and hours and hours away from his wife and children because she was taking care of them the way writers' wives do, I'm told. But like, if you're a writer and a parent, you don't have that. You're finding little spaces of time here and there. And so if your reading life is also in the kind of environment that the thing you're writing is, it just really helps, I find, because then you've got two parts of your brain that are always stuck in that world. And maybe that's enough to overcome the part of your brain that's busy, like trying to help your kid figure out how to upload a video to a Google Doc because she has to do it for her assignment, which is due tomorrow. The book that I'm working on now, which is fiction, isn't exactly historical fiction, but it is set in the past, but it's the recent past. It's the early 1990s and then the mid 2000s. And so in some ways it's a time and place that I lived in, or that was very close to a time and place that I lived in. And so while writing that book, I have found it unbelievably helpful to just read a shit ton of fiction from that era. And I mean, yeah. It helps that the main character of my book is a reader and is very, and works in books and is very tuned into and a little bit borderline obsessed with the contemporary fiction of her time. And so, you know, so there's the salutary effect of, okay, I'm sort of just putting myself in a big bubbling pot of the era and making sure that that everything that's coming into my brain is the same kind of stuff that would be that is coming into my main character's brain. But also as a fiction writer, it so often helped me solve the problem that maybe you don't have, but which I certainly always have, which is, okay, what's the next thing that's going to happen? And sometimes that thing is obvious because you have a particular place you want the plot to go, but sometimes it's not obvious at all. And so I found myself using the books I was reading, books like Fiscadoro, for example, by Dennis Johnson, but also other books of the 80s and early 90s, using them as kind of just straight up stealing moments from them as writing prompts, taking something from one of those books, transplanting a key element from it into the universe of my book, and then just fucking seeing what happened. There's in Fiscadoro, there's this incredible set of scenes between a kid in this post-apocalyptic Florida and an elder, and the elder was a member of the symphony, like the Miami Symphony Orchestra or something, before the apocalypse came. And he's teaching this kid clarinet. And at one point in my book, I just didn't know what the next thing was going to be. I knew I needed like a moment that was a little bit out of the narrative and a little bit lyrical. And so I just fucking stole that kid and his clarinet, and I put him into the house where my main characters lived and figured out what would happen next to him. And that was so valuable. And it, as a writer, I find it really, it's a fun Easter egg for me personally to know that there's this character from the books of that time living in this world. No one else is going to ever get it besides me. But getting it isn't the point. The point is that it gave me a tool that felt exactly right for the next thing, which is exactly what I needed at that time.
Yeah, man, that is a god. I would highly recommend that, and I'm going to steal that idea from you, because yeah, I think the other thing that I think about, you know, like I from when I was quite young, and I think it's a product of reading like Chuck Palahniuk when those first books came out, and possibly reading Jesus Son and those kind of books, is that everything has to be new, you know, like it has to be the first time. And this is what I think, and at the moment I'm kind of writing a little bit about the Challenger, a little bit about the Apollo missions, you know, and I just think this thing you're saying is that, and I think Train Dreams in its entirety teaches me that, you know, there are various ways of coming at things, you know what I mean? Like things will always be reimagined because they're coming through a different mind. And yeah. I think that is exciting for me because, you know, like having limited myself to only, you know, sort of my life. I think that it is a really, it was a really good lesson for me reading this book. Do you mind if we just touch on, we're sort of coming to the end, but I just wonder if we just touch on the end of the book. Yeah. It's astounding. It's transcendent. It's, you know, like, he kind of dies, you know, and that all gets wrapped up, and then the book kind of reanimates. I don't know, like I have never been quite so affected by the end of a book, and like it comes with, you know, like obviously when you're reading it as a paper book, you know that you're getting near the end, but it really just, wow. I don't know, have you got anything to say about the ending?
So we learn of his death, hold on, let me find it, about 4 pages before the ending. Right, Grenier himself lived more than 80 years, well into the 1960s. He dies, here's where he is laid. And then it gives us one more scene. But I think the ending of the book also encompasses not only the scene after his death, but the scene before his death. This week or so in which he finds himself late in his years, it says, we're meant to believe it's maybe in his 40s or 50s, overcome by an unaccountable lust. He is like, you know, this is a guy who never slept with a woman other than his wife in a marriage that only lasted a few years before she died. who is, if not deeply religious, deeply moral, and even buttoned up in and moralistic in the ways of his time. Sex is almost unthinkable and terrifying to him. But for this one week, he's just, you know, he's like lying. It's like a hot summer evening. He's lying outside, sleeping under the stars and waking up, touching himself. He can't control himself. And the way that he's overcome by his own body this late in life, a time when he thought he had mastered it, is just so surprising. And maybe the moment I think in this book that it reminds me the most of other Dennis Johnson, of like Jesus's Son, for example, where you feel just the tiniest sense of a modern sensibility in this tale of long ago. And it's not intrusive, and it doesn't hurt the narrative, but it's one of the only ways in which this book couldn't have been written in 1885, right? In 1885, a writer never includes this section. A writer in the 21st century can include this section, and it tells us so much more about this person to find himself overwhelmed by, in essence, his own animalness, right? His own animal nature taking him over in a way. And he doesn't know what to do about it, and he is tempted to go into town and not even sleep with someone, but just go to a show and look at Miss Galveston. Instead, he goes out for a long hike in the woods and spends the night sleeping above a lake, and he feels the lust come off of him and flow down into the valleys, he says. And there's this final moment just before we see his death where he's standing on a cliff above a lake, a path through the woods that he's never gone on before. We're meant to understand this is a completely new route to this familiar place that he's, you know, because he's bushwhacking through still untouched virgin wilderness. And he sees far away the Canadian Rockies, hundreds of miles away, still with the snow capped on them. And there's this line, "The forests that filled his life were so thickly populous and so tall that generally they blocked him from seeing how far away the world was." So he spends his whole life literally not seeing the forest for the trees, and then he's granted this one moment to see the forest despite the trees. And it brings him a kind of peace. It pulls the lust from his body, and it carries him. We're meant to understand, I think, that this peace carries him the rest of his days to the day that he dies in that same cabin in 1968, long after his own life. But then, we go back. We go back to this one moment where it's not with his daughter, but it's meant to remind us of his daughter. It's this moment, it's not with Miss Galveston, but it's meant to remind us of Miss Galveston. He goes back to the theater where he didn't see Miss Galveston. He sees a bunch of, sort of sideshow vaudevillian carny type characters, including a wolf boy who lets loose this unearthly howl, which is like the last resonating sound in this book, full of resonating sounds just echoing through the whole world. We're told it's meant to be like the origin of all these sounds as mankind has heard them ever since the beginning of time and will hear them till the end of time. And the idea of writing a book that just goes ahead and in its last sentences tells you, I'm talking about the universe. That is terrifying, but also so inspiring. This book I'm writing doesn't do that shit at all, but like, maybe I could someday, I don't know.
It is genius. It's wild. Hey, you're in America. Did you ever see him read or anything?
I never did. No, I'm so sad.
He was due to New Zealand. It's just, oh my gosh. It's wild. Thank you so much, Dan. Holy crap.
This was so fun.
Like, it's so lovely to talk to you, but also thank you so much for, I'm just off to grab every Dennis Johnson book I can find now, and I feel like such an idiot for me. I feel like he might be my Shirley Jackson as well, which I only started reading a year ago as well, because I'm an idiot. But thank you so much.
We all live long lives, and there's so much to read. What a joy to find someone new. One great thing about Dennis Johnson is that you are going to love a lot of the stuff you read of his, and a lot of the stuff you're going to be like, what the fuck, Dennis Johnson? This isn't good at all. What are you doing? He lived a long life and tried a lot of shit, and some of it really worked and some of it didn't. But boy, was he had no fear, this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is, like I say, that short story that I read maybe 15 years ago, you know, with the image of a soldier sleeping on a beach. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, he's a genius. Anyway, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And have a lovely rest of the week.
Thank you. See you in Wellington someday, I hope.
Yay! We would like that a lot. Mm-hmm.